It's time for another episode of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes. Here's your host, Terrence McCauley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. My guest today is George Pelicanos. He is the best-selling author of 22 novels and story collections set in and around Washington, D.C. He is also a producer and Emmy-nominated writer of The Wire, Dream, The Deuce, and We Own the City. Owning Up is his latest novel and is available from Mulholland Books. Sir, thank you for being here today.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Sure. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Owning Up?
It is a compilation of four novellas, all set in and around Washington, D.C., as all my novels are. Mm-hmm. And, jumps around in time. It goes back to 1919. There's one in the 1970s. A couple of stories are based on historical events based around them. And then there's one that's about a no-knock warrant and the execution of a no-knock warrant on a house and what it does to a family. There it is. Just very kind of varied things that I was interested in. And I didn't think they were books, novels, standalone, but I thought they'd make good novellas. And I actually like that. I like that format. Some of my favorite writers, like Jim Harrison, I thought did their best work with novellas.
Right. I just released one myself, and it's amazing how recently you've seen a lot of people starting to drift back toward that format, isn't it? I mean, the short story enjoyed a little bit of a boom there for a while. Unfortunately, it didn't last very long, particularly in the crime fiction space, because there were a lot of great writers who got their start there. But it was it's interesting how the novella has become popular again.
Well, I don't know if they're popular, to be honest with you.
Well, with writers.
Yeah, with writers, sure. If you just want to write what you want to write, that's a great way to do it. I don't think it's the key to commercial success necessarily, but I'm at the point right now where I just want to write the books I want to write,
Right. Right. And it's interesting that in the phase of your career you can understand that, because a lot of people say, "Well, I want to write a novella, or I want to write a collection of short stories. How come, or I want to start my own anthology. How come the publishing industry isn't beating down my door to publish this stuff?" And people don't realize it takes a lot of effort for them to market every single book they publish, whether it's by a known author like you or somebody who isn't very well known or who's a first-time author. And there's not a lot of money when you go into the smaller efforts like novellas or short story compilations.
Right, but they still have to work as hard to put them out, and I'm sensitive to that,
Right. Yeah, and that's what I think. I always suggest people who are frustrated with the industry understand that it is a business, and they have to work just as hard for a 96-page book as they do to market a 326-page book.
Correct.
So you have done writing on both sides of the house. You've been a novelist, and you've also written for the screen. What are some of the lessons that you learned doing each discipline, and how have they helped you in the opposite discipline?
Well, I don't know. I think, obviously it's a different kind of writing, but I do feel like, for me, writing, especially writing for television, made me a better novelist eventually. And the reason is I never went to a writing school. Mm-hmm. I have a bachelor's degree in film, and I never sat in a room before I was in television. I never sat in a room with other writers and had them sort of break down your work and critique your work and all that sort of stuff, because I didn't really think I'd respond well to that.
Right.
But when you're forced to, you can learn a lot. And On The Wire in particular, which was my first television show 22 years ago, there was a lot of argument in that room, and it was a bunch of sort of thick-skinned guys that didn't care what they said to you, and that kind of helped me a little bit, you know what I mean? And it helped with my sense of story and things of that nature. And also the discipline of writing a script is, as you know, it's all action and dialogue. There's
Right.
nothing, whatever's on, if it's going to go to the screen, it's got to be on the page. But if it's not going to go up on the screen, then you cut it out or you don't write it. There's no
Right.
backstory or anything like that. Unless it's in dialogue, you can't get off the track, which is very, very disciplining for a novelist, you know, because there's times when you're writing a novel where you say, wait a minute, this, what am I doing? This is getting away from me. Like,
Right.
I got to get back to the story. The reason somebody's going to buy this book is because of the story and the characters.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and it's refreshing to hear someone with your experience say that, because I know a lot of newer authors start have that kind of problem too, and they think it's their inexperience or imposter syndrome that they have no business trying to tell a story this complex. But that's not the case. The stories tend to take a life of their own once we start putting key finger to keyboard.
That's right.
Yeah, they certainly do. And then so you took a lot of the discipline that you got from the writers' rooms, and then you brought it into your novellas, your novels and your other work. Did it help you with character formation of your novels as well? I figured that the plot it certainly helped you, but what about the kind of characters? What kind of writer were you before that's being a television writer as a novelist, and how was it afterwards based on your characters?
I mean, I wish I could say that there's so much in television, there's so much pre-planning before you write. You beat out every episode scene by scene. So, well, first you sit in the room in the beginning, and all you do is talk about the characters and the arc of the story and the arc of the characters and so on.
Right.
You might do that for a month before you ever get down to individual scenes. So by then you know who the characters are. And then you beat out the script scene by scene. And so the writer walks out of there with a beat sheet, which is a note by note, scene by scene roadmap to go out to go write the script.
Okay.
I wish I could say that transferred to my novel writing, but I don't outline my novels at all.
Right.
And I still don't to this day. I have a situation. I start writing the characters. I know this, you've heard this a million times, but it's just the truth. I don't know why it's the truth, but once you start writing, the characters are talking back to you, and the novel begins to write itself. It
Yeah,
does.
I know. I know it's funny because people who don't understand, who have not experienced that, don't understand it, and sounds completely crazy to them. But for
It
people
does.
like us who get it, we understand it, and that's why I'm laughing, because I know exactly that feeling. They do take over, and yeah, it's us, it's our minds and our consciousness focusing in a certain direction, but it's a direction that we don't necessarily plan, and that's where the magic happens. It really is wonderful.
And the reason that it has to be that way in television is because all the scripts are linked, but they're written by different writers. So you can't, you know, you have to have a detailed beat sheet because you can't go off the rails because you're screwing everybody that's coming after you. And you can't just have the characters do what you want them to do. It's a house of cards that falls apart if you do that. So it has to be that way. But, you know, and as far as the novel goes, what I was describing is one of the reasons why I don't get scared anymore when I'm writing a book, because I know it's historically it's worked out in the past. It will work out again. There's a lot of times when I'm stuck, I just keep writing.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that I've learned is best as well. There's a big difference between being cocky and being confident. And once you've finished a book or you've finished writing a script, you at least know one thing, and that's that you can do it. And that answers a lot of those nagging questions and doubts that creep into a creative person's head.
Yeah, I mean, if there's people watching this that want to write and haven't written before, my main advice is you go to work every day, you treat it like a job. There's days that it's not that good what you put mm-hmm. down, but put something down on paper on your screen. And you can't rewrite a blank page. You know what I mean? And you just have to keep working every day and try to shoot for a number of pages if you can, but write something.
Right. Yeah. At least have some progress so that you're not starting cold after a couple of days of inaction, because, you know, life gets in the way too. And it's, you know, we have chores, errands, doctor's appointments, stuff like that, that we have to do. But when it's in our creative best interest, it's best to put the work in, because it ultimately does pay off.
Yep. Hopefully.
Hopefully it does. Yeah, it really does. So do you enjoy writing series more, or do you like writing, and I'm talking about book series here, or standalone novels, or does each present its own kind of challenge for you?
Well, historically, I like the series if I like the character, but I've never gone, I think with Derek Strange, I went 5 books, and the reason I got 5 books out of it is I jumped around in time. There's books of him as a young man, and there's books of him as a middle-aged man, and I really like that character, but, you know, I'm well aware of the fact that nobody ever said the 8th book in the series is as good as the 2nd or 1st book. No, never. I mean, you might, there's a guy, people like Michael Connelly can write a ton of Bosch books and they're all very high quality, but right. I don't have that gene. You know what I mean? And I know it. I know that I'll get bored. And if I get bored, the book's going to be boring. So I've always eventually dropped out of series and gone to standalones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine for you, they are palette refreshers to write from a creative perspective.
Yes. Yeah, and this book was really, you know, I haven't written a book, I think, in 4 years because of all television I've been doing. And it was nice to come back and do these 4 novellas and sort of feel like I did when I was first starting out, meaning there was a lot of energy there. The faucet was on, you know, I'd come to work every day and I'd just write, and I was writing, it was coming very easily. And I think it's because I was telling 4 new stories.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's different when you're writing for a paycheck, if you will, and when a project is a labor of love. And I think that we always need both as writers, but it's those passion projects, if you will, that really keep those creative juices flowing.
Yes.
Yeah, they really seem to be. So do you envision yourself, I know that this was this book is a 4 novella compendium, if you will. Do you think that you might approach your next work of fiction from the same vein, or do you think you might do something else, like maybe start a new series or of books? Where are the creative muse taking you right now?
I'll probably write a novel next. I think, you know, that old thing, one for them, one for you, that kind of thing. I want the publisher to make money because they've worked hard. And because I want to keep working, you know, it's as simple as that. So
yeah,
I will probably write something that's, you know, more marketable, put it that way.
Right.
And I think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it really is. And that's a great philosophy to have. And I've heard you be interviewed elsewhere, and it's, you know, you're very much a writer's writer, but you also get the business side of the business. Because as you said before, there a lot of effort goes into bringing out each of these books, and it's you need to be able to be profitable and make it worth their while. So it's not being you know, you have to be a little bit unselfish at times and keep that in mind. And you always have.
I've got, you know, I've got more work to do in television and films, and but I'm getting to the point where that's not going to last forever because of my age. And so, you know, I'm going to put a few more years into that and then write books until the end. That's my plan. And by the end, I mean my death. That's a cheerful thought, right?
With St. Patrick's Day coming up, are you sure you're not Irish? Because that's a very Irish outlook. God almighty. You sound like my mom now. Oh, God. But no, I get it. And, you know, it's you know, every career has a sunset, whether you're a professional baseball player or a writer. And I think that, you know, that definitely I think novels tend to get better as the writer ages because they get to see a little bit more about life and people and they can plumb those depths a little bit more.
Yeah, there's more wisdom behind it as you go along. My early books would not, I couldn't write those books now. Those were punk rock detective novels when I was out there, you know.
Right.
I don't know if the books necessarily get better after a point. You it's all about energy and passion, right?
Right.
And so you have to keep that up. I think you got to stay engaged with the world. Go out there and make sure you talk to people. And my stuff is really research intensive, and which, you know, I like, obviously. I mean, the last TV show I did, We Own the City, we spent a couple of years researching it before we even started writing. And that part of that was due to the pandemic, but we really wanted to make sure that it was right because it was based on real people. And a lot of these guys went to prison and, you know, we didn't. There's a thing about, they say, well, you can't libel a dead person and you can't libel a felon who's gone to prison, right? But it doesn't mean you should.
Right.
So, which, you know, I try to do a lot of research and the research, going out there and talking to people and embedding yourself with the police or just going into neighborhoods and talking to people, that's what sparks the creativity for me. Mm-hmm.
And what, in your opinion, is the elements that make up a really compelling crime story? Because for me, I think first you have to have a really compelling story. And then it has to be, you know, if it happens to be a crime or a romance or sci-fi, whatever, horror, that's fine. But first you have to have a compelling story. What are your secrets?
You know, it all comes from the characters. I mean, if you locate who the characters are and you let them speak honestly, it's all about honesty for me. It's like, there's books to be written about misogynists and there's books to be written about people who have problems with race. And it doesn't mean the author is a racist or a misogynist. Those, mm-hmm. those stories can illuminate a lot of things. And if you're not afraid to speak honestly about those things, then you're not really, it's the death of art. This whole idea that you can't write about that.
Right.
Is something that I reject. And it's become sort of insidious in our business. You wouldn't believe some of the things I hear in meetings about what you can and cannot write anymore. And I don't agree with it. I think you should be able to write about anything if you do it honestly.
Right. And if you do it with an idea that, you know, it could be controversial or it could be damaging to people, but that's what art is about. It's about challenging those things. And it's also a public way for the artist to see their way through things that are happening in society while the piece is being created. And I think that journey is valid, just as you said.
Yeah, I mean, what's Lehane's book this year? What was that called? Little Mercies? Something like that?
Yes, yeah.
Is that the name of it?
I believe so, yeah.
I'm really bad with titles, but okay, it's a really good book. And one of the reasons that it's such a good book is that the main character who you're supposed to be follow and be in league with is pretty much a woman, an Irish woman from a Southie from in the 70s in Boston. So she's going to have racial attitudes that we don't agree with, you know, the reader right. doesn't agree with. But still, it's a wonderful book because he wrote honestly about it and you learn something.
No, it really is important. Yeah, no, I agree that it, and especially with your career, besides just your novels, when you're writing The Wire, you wrote about people, and the other writers on that show wrote about people who weren't necessarily admirable. A lot of them were criminals, but they had a compelling quality to them that made the audience want to know more. And even though you knew that these were bad people in some respects, you wanted to keep reading, watching about them every single week.
Yeah, pretty proud of that. Even, you know, even We Own the City, like the cops that were essentially criminals, we gave them a voice too. You know, there's scenes in that show where they say, the cop said, the worst of them says to the woman who's geez, I'm losing my train of thought here, but she's interviewing him and she says, you've got 47 complaints against you, brutality complaints. And he says, you know who doesn't have brutality complaints? Cops who don't get out of their cars. And it's the truth, you know, because since Freddie Gray in Baltimore, a lot of cops just stopped getting out of their cars. They didn't want to get prosecuted. And Jenkins, when he's trying to convince this other cop to take some money that they looted from a car wash raid, he says, you know, why wouldn't we take the money? He says, if we got shot today and killed, well, what would our families get? A folded flag.
Mm-hmm.
And some kind of bullshit medal. You know what I mean? And I like the fact that we can present both sides and sort of try to, the stuff I do, I try to hit the middle. I'm not looking for the far left or the far right to agree to me with me.
Right, right.
I want to go right down the center because those are the people where you can move the needle.
Exactly right. Yeah. And it was just like with The Wire and also the show you didn't work on, The Shield. I get nervous when people say, oh, I love the Vic Mackey character. He was awesome. It was, something to aspire to. And when people say that, I say, you know what? You missed the entire point of the show because the guy he does cool things and he does some good things for people, but he's not a good guy. And the show never portrays him that way. And that was the beauty of the show. That was, and his, you know, conspirators, if you will, they were all great actors, had some awesome performances, but these weren't the good guys. And that's what I think crime fiction at its heart can achieve when it wants to.
Yeah. And look, it ended tragically for all those guys. And Vic, in fact, I think the worst thing happens to him is they put him on desk duty, right? Isn't mm-hmm. that how it ends?
Yeah, and it's
the worst thing that could happen to that guy.
Yeah, but the final scene was awesome. It was one of my favorite final scenes when he's going home for the night from his dead-end office job. He looks at his gun. He locks up the thing, puts the gun in his back pocket, and then you can tell he's cooking on something else to get himself back. And you don't know if he's going to get it. You know he's guilty as hell. But again, compelling stuff, and it ended the right way. So it was that's what great crime fiction, I think, always does. Now for you, I know that you've got a lot, you said earlier, you've got a lot of TV projects up. You've got a lot of, I was wondering, when is your next novel project going to come to light, if you can tell us?
I haven't started anything yet. It'll come to me.
Yeah, as it always has, right?
Yeah.
Sir, what's the best way people can follow you on social media or your website, things like that?
I'm on Facebook, but I don't post a lot, but I'm on there. And I sometimes I'll put up stuff like curating a series at the American Film Institute Theater here in Silver Spring, Maryland on Westerns right now. So once a week I screen a Western film and I introduce it. I'd give about a 15-minute introduction. And I did last year I did 70s exploitation films. So it's something that I'm really enjoying, and it's probably the most enjoyable thing I've done in many, many years. And so I usually put up something about that, what I'm about to screen.
Wow. Well, that's a great place for people to look for it. And also, I got to ask you, as a Western writer myself, any thoughts on possibly taking your hand at a Western?
I would love it. I would love it. I'd love to make a, I don't think I have the chops to do a Western novel, but I think that I could certainly write or direct a Western film. And it's one of the things that is on my list. Right. So hopefully, and now there's a resurgence of Westerns. There was many, many years where I would pitch stuff and they'd say Westerns are dead, and they're very much alive again. So that's good for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And as someone who writes them, it's good for me too. I'm very happy about that.
What's your favorite Western film off the top of your head?
For me, it's The Searchers, and it's not because of the rah-rah John Wayne stuff, but because it does deal with a lot of underlying ugliness of back then and of the 1950s. And for those reasons, it's I think it's an important Western.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
Did you read the book? Yeah,
I did. The book is very much different. And
yeah, it is.
But I love how the changes they made in the from the book to the film actually work. And it's a much more mysterious, broader story. Of course, with John Ford, you've always got that humor that's a little cringy as those films age. But I have to say, they were all really great changes.
I don't think that the humor mars the film, but it doesn't ruin the film. You know what
right.
I mean? It's the kind of thing when you're watching, after you watch it several times, you want to sort of skip through that if you can.
Yes. Yeah, but you know what? It was at a time when they were competing with television, so they felt like they had to have a little bit of everything in every film. And I totally get it. Exactly what you said. Some of that stuff, like, God damn, can't you just skip past this stuff?
Yeah.
But anyway, it was. And the other one that comes to mind is Outlaw Josie Wales, which I had the chance to see on the big screen back in 2011 during the Turner Classic Film Festival in L.A. And that was an experience. It's a much different movie when you see it on the big screen than on your television.
I introduced that at the AFI last year. I gave a long talk about it. And I know Unforgiven is the one, but I think Outlaw Josie Wales is his best film and one of the greatest Westerns of all time.
Yeah,
no doubt.
He really knew how to direct himself in that one, which makes it even tougher. Because, you know, he knew all of his iconic angles. He knew how just to show himself, really. And of course, the back and forth between him and a bunch of different characters was just awesome.
Well, I don't know how much time we have. You'll probably cut this, but there's a scene at the end. There's a scene at the end of the film between him and John Vernon when they finally meet at the end. And everything, it's what I call perfect cinema, that scene. Everything about it, the writing, the acting, Jerry Fielding's music. There's a little return to the Rose of Alabama theme in there.
Yeah.
Behind the scene. It's one of the most perfect scenes ever filmed, I think. And for that alone, it's worth the price of the ticket.
It definitely is. Yeah. And it's a lot of the great angles that he definitely lifted from some of the Ford films. The one of him in shadow in the doorway, and just he was able to build the tension so well without killing it, and while giving himself some great time, he really understood who he was and what he was at that time, and it's a pleasure to watch that unfold. You know, the other one was Tombstone, which is great, but that seemed like more of a happy accident than something that they planned was going to be a great film.
My favorite Wyatt Earp film is Hour of the Gun, John Sturges.
Right, with James Garner.
Yeah, and Jason Robards is Doc Holliday. That's a really undersung film. Close second is My Darling Clementine, John Ford.
Yes, with Henry Fonda in that one.
Yep.
And that was not DeForest Kelly who was in that one. That was the one
You're
with...
He was in Gunfight at the OK Corral.
Yeah, with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas.
Yeah. Also Sturgis.
Yes. Yes. Also Sturgis is right. Yeah. No, that was whenever you talk about doing research, when you do research into the whole Wyatt Earp, Ike Lanton fight, it becomes a lot broader and a lot more interesting than we even realize today. It was a fascinating conflict that was not as clear cut as people think. It was long simmering. It was political. It was tawdry. The events happened. And if you ever got a chance, if you haven't already, and you go to Tombstone, you see how these people were shooting at each other. It's not a big area at all. It's very small. It's about the size of a regular garage today.
Right.
And it was close range and brutal. So it was, it definitely puts a different shine on it than what we see that we might think. But anyway, well, we'll definitely talk about Westerns for a few minutes more after we finish recording here. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today and to give our audience a glimpse into your creative process.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us for another edition of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes right here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next time.
You have been listening to Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes with host Terrence McCauley on Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.